the rich blessings that we have is just that, the fellowship of saints in light. And I think associated with that is the transformation of character. You know, so often we look at the ministry of Brother Russell and we think, well, what did he really put forth before the household of faith? Well, he set out the plan in the divine plan of the ages, and he spent a lot of time interpreting the prophetic word and laying things out for us there through his ministry. But I think often overlooked is the concept that he introduced, that he clarified brilliantly what a consecrated life is all about. He really laid it down, what it means to live for Christ and what consecration really is all about. And that transformation of character, well, that's precious, isn't it? That's like gold and jewels to us when we see elements of divine character being assimilated and developed, crystallized within us, so that as we interact with mankind in everyday situations, by God's grace, we're able to radiate the love of God to them in a way that they rarely see. Because it's the Spirit of God coming out of us that they experience. And likewise, those who would treat us evil, those who might have conflict with us, for whatever reason, I think we're oft amazed at the sweetness that we are able to exhibit toward them in our conduct, the goodness, the fairness, the loving nature of our behavior. So all those regulations of character adjustment in our Christian lives, those are just absolutely essential to us. Those are true riches indeed. And yet, for all our character development, we're still very much in the flesh. I wake up every morning only to discover that there is my flesh with me each and every day. And it does things that I really wish it would not do. And there are times, experiences I'm going through and events in daily life when I almost feel like the kid at the amusement park who's driving the car on the little turnpike ride there, who suddenly discovers that he could just turn the wheel this way all day and the car will still go where it wants to go. Sometimes I feel like that with my flesh, and I'm sitting back and there's that voice inside my head that's saying to me, that's not a good idea. Don't say that. Don't do that. And of course, that's what I say and that's what I do. And that might be the subtitle to this talk, bringing up the ark, or that's not a good idea. Well, of course, it was a good idea to bring the ark up, but many of the events associated with the bringing up of the ark of the Lord into the city of Jerusalem by King David were attended by some very bad ideas that better thought or cooler heads might have avoided. In Judges 13, we read of a period of time in which the children of Israel, because of their disobedience, had been placed under punishment by the Lord for a period of 40 years. That punishment was designed to rebuke and assist them in coming back into line with the divine mind and the divine will. It is during this period of time that one of the judges, Eli, was serving as high priest of Israel. And it is during this time that a young, dynamic man of God by the name of Samuel was beginning his period of judgeship on behalf of Israel. And very interesting to me, it seems also that their contemporary was none other than Samson, whom the Lord used in other parts of Israel for deliverance from the Philistines. We take up the narrative in 1 Samuel chapter 4. You know the scene. The word of the Lord, word of Samuel, came to all Israel, and Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, the Philistines encamped at Aphek, and the Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated. They were defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" "I know. Let's bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." That's a bad idea. Nevertheless, they did that. But, you know, it's the elders of the people who made these suggestions. And it's interesting that it's the elders of the people who said, well, they didn't say this. They didn't say, "Why have the Philistines defeated us today in battle?" They said, "Why is it that the Lord defeated us today in battle?" Well, the answer is clear. And the answer had already been spoken to them by Samuel. "You are going to endure 40 years of subjection to the Philistines for your disobedience. It's a corrective punishment to you from the Lord." Well, in thinking of bringing up the ark, they did have precedent. As they're talking among themselves, perhaps they thought of the account in Numbers chapter 10. Verses 33 through 36. "The people of Israel set out from the mount of the Lord, 3 days' journey. The ark of the covenant of the Lord went before them, 3 days' journey, to seek out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Lord was over them by day, wherever they sent out from the camp. And whenever the ark set out, Moses said, 'Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you.' And when it rested, he said, 'Return, O Lord, to the thousand thousands of Israel.'" And so there's a precedent where Israel went before. If the ark went before them, the enemies of Israel would be decimated. They'd run away. But not that experience alone. They also probably thought of that time when they crossed over the Jordan River into the promised land under the leadership of Joshua. And in Joshua chapter 3, verses 1 through 4, we read this. "Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim, and they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, 'As soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priests, then you shall set out from your place, and you will follow it.'" Skipping to verse 6, "They took up the Ark of the Covenant, and they went before the people. And the Lord said, 'Today, Joshua, I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you.'" And in verse 10, Joshua says, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing before you into Jordan." So the Ark of the Lord passes before you into Jordan, and thus it is that the Lord drives out your enemies. So there they are in the field of battle, back in 1 Samuel chapter 4. What do we need to do to win in battle? We need to bring the Ark of the Covenant of God into battle before us. There are many considerations that they should have taken to heart. There is a proverb, Proverbs 14:12, that tells us, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death." In this experience, they knew that they were under 40 years of punishment from the Lord. What would have been the right thing to do? I think the right thing to do would be to say, Lord, your wisdom is far beyond ours. You have determined a just and righteous punishment because you're a just and righteous God. And we'll submit for 40 years under this punishment. We'll learn our lessons and we'll make corrections in our behavior. But instead, they chose to follow their own will and resist the will of the Lord on their behalf. And I think we as Christians sometimes can be that way. In Hebrews chapter 12, the apostle tells us, my son, do not wither, do not become faint at the rebuke of the Lord on your behalf. Because the Lord disciplines, he corrects, he chastises all his children who come to him. If you're without disciplines, you're not really the Lord's. And so as disciplining experiences come into our lives and we, by our spiritual understanding, perceive that it's the Lord who's allowing this, it's the Lord who's giving us this experience, instead of trying to shrug the experience off or come out from under it and be willfully denying the Lord's overruling in our lives, I think so often it's good for us to say, just and true are thy ways, O Lord God Almighty, and to submit to his will and to embrace the disciplines that he has given us for our benefit. I think that's the major lesson we learned from this example in 1 Samuel 4. Well, we know the story. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, came and took the ark of the Lord into battle. Did it have the desired effect? It did not. The people of Israel were summarily defeated. The ark was taken captive. The Philistines won the battle. And 30,000 soldiers of Israel were slain that day. Well, the Philistines thought that they would benefit from having the Ark of God. Let's read of their experiences as we continue in 1 Samuel chapter 5. The Philistines, having the Ark of God, took it with them from Ebenezer to Ashdod. They took the Ark of God into the house of Dagon. They put it by the side of the god Dagon, by the idol. When the people of Ashdod got up early in the morning after, they saw that Dagon had come down to the earth on his face before the Ark of the Lord. They took up Dagon and put him in his place again. That was a bad idea. Again, to resist the power and the authority of the Creator of the universe is never a good idea. When the Lord is sending us a message, when the Lord is sending us a sign, let our hearts be sensitive in realizing that he's trying to express his will to us and be obedient to him. Well, it was a bad idea to try to set up Dagon again by the Ark of God, because in verse 4, when they get up early the next morning, Dagon had come down to the earth on his face before the Ark of the Lord, and his head and his hands were broken off on the doorstep, and only the base was in its place. Well, Dagon was their powerful god. This should have been a signal to them that it was displeasing to the God of Israel to have his ark in their possession. But no, they thought that the answer was to not keep it in their possession in that town any longer, but let's pack up the Ark of God and take it to the town of Ekron. And taking it to the town of Ekron, the people of the town made an outcry. They said, they've sent the Ark of God, of the God of Israel, to us for the destruction of us and of our people. And so they sent and they got together all the lords of the Philistines, and they said, we've got to send the Ark back. that's causing us to be ill and to have tumors and to have painful experiences. And so it was that the people of the Philistines took two milk cows and a new wagon, and they set the ark on it. And they sent the ark off to the people of Israel. And in sending it out, they determined that, well, if it goes back to the people of Israel, we'll know that this was all of God. But if it comes back to us, then, well, maybe we will receive it again. I think, thankfully, for their sakes, it did go back to the people of Israel. But as it did, in 1 Samuel 6, beginning in verse 11, they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the chest with the gold images representing their diseases, and the cows took the straight way by the road to Beth Shemesh. They went by the highway, not turning to the right or to the left, and the sound of their voices was clear on the road, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the edge of Beth Shemesh. And lo and behold, the people of Beth Shemesh were out working in their fields, cutting grain in the valley. And they lifted up their eyes, and they must have squinted a bit and wondered, is that what I think it is? Yes, it's the Ark of God coming back into our presence. And they were full of joy when they saw it. And the cart came into the field of Joshua the Beth Shemite and came to a stop there by a great stone. And they cut up the wood of the cart, and they burnt a burnt offering of the cows to the Lord. That was a good idea. And in their overzealousness, you know, the Lord has favored us, the Lord has given us all this, maybe they felt licensed to go a little further than they should have. Some of them felt, well, God has favored us so greatly, and he's brought the ark into our midst right here in Beth Shemesh. Maybe it'd be okay if I just took a peek inside. It was a bad idea. The Levites took the ark of the Lord and the chest with the golden images, put them on the great stone. The lords of the Philistines saw this and left. But the Lord, in verse 19 of 1 Samuel 6, sent destruction on 50,070 men of the people of Beth Shemesh for looking into the ark of the Lord. And great was the sorrow of the people for the destruction which the Lord had sent upon them. 50,070. Now, in some of your modern translations, it may read a little differently. If you have the King James Bible, it does read 50,070. And we think, why would the Lord slay 50,070 people because a few people in Beth Shemesh peeked into the ark? Or if the ark was there a long time and people start peeking into it and dying, you know, 10,000 deaths later, and there's these piles of bodies laying there in the field, wouldn't you think that they would say, maybe that is a bad idea? Well, I think that there's a problem with the translation here. The word 50,000 is apparently spelled in the Hebrew in a very different way than if you wanted to actually write the number 50,000. It would probably more appropriately or accurately be translated this way. 50 of 1,000. 50 of 1,000. Now, if you think the average size of a village, a community, farming community, was maybe about 1,400 people, and the Lord slays 50 of 1,000 in the village, that would be 70 people. And we think that history corroborates that. You know, when Josephus was writing his history of the wars of the Jews, he makes note of this account. And in his account, he said that there were 70 who were slain for peeking into the ark. And I like that thought. You know, not that God would just reach out and unreasonably find 50,070 people to slay for the actions of just a few, but that 70, who were 50 out of each 1,000 of the community, were slain. Well, in verse 20, the men of Beth Shemesh say, "Who was able to keep his place before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom may he go from us? Where should we put the ark?" Well, you would think, wouldn't you, that the idea would be to take it back to Shiloh and put it back in the tabernacle where it belongs. But they made another decision that I think in the long term proved to be a bad idea. They sent to the people living in Kiriath Jearim saying, "The Philistines have sent back the ark of the Lord. Come and take it up to your country." And so the men of Kiriath Jearim came and they took the ark of the Lord to the house of Abinadab in Gibeah. And they made his son Eleazar holy and put the ark in his care. Well, the house of Abinadab was set up high on a hill, far removed from the community. And you know, I can just imagine them saying, "Well, we'll put it there temporarily until we get this thing figured out." You know, the killing of the 70 in Beth Shearim was a tragedy. And let's just think this thing over and maybe eventually we'll get the ark back. But you know the old saying, brethren, out of sight, out of mind. And that's what happened to the Ark of the Covenant. It was out of sight. It was out of mind. And it's recorded in the scriptures that the people did not consult the Ark of the Lord until it was returned to Jerusalem. How long a period of time was that? Well, there's a little potential confusion in the account. In 1 Samuel 7, verse 2, we read this, that the ark was in Kiriath Jearim for a long time, as much as 20 years, and all Israel was searching after the Lord with weeping. And so you read that and you think, well, the ark was there for 20 years, wasn't it? And the answer, actually, when we consider the scriptures on it, is no. It was there for much longer. We think that this period of 20 years was the final 20 years of oppression of the people of Israel under that 40-year period of persecution by the Philistines that we read about in Judges chapter 13. And the people made a big cry unto the Lord, and finally Samuel intervenes and said, "All right, if with all your hearts you would come back to the Lord and put away all the strange God and the Asherim, the Astarts among you, let your hearts be turned to the Lord, be servants to him only, and he will make you safe from the hands of the Philistines." So this is that 20-year period, but the ark was actually in the house of Abinadab for much longer than that. Because think about it. The account of Saul being made king follows later on in the account in Samuel, doesn't it? And Saul was king for 40 years. 40 years of his kingship, and then David is anointed to be king, and David is in the land of Hebron for 7.5 years, and finally comes to Jerusalem. Well, brethren, it was really about a period of 70 years then that the ark sat idol in the house of Abinadab. 70 years out of sight and out of mind. But let us never be deceived that we can set aside the truth. Never let us be deceived that we can set aside our privileges of duty to the truth. We can never set aside our obligation to the Lord and his people without consequence. out of sight and out of mind. I think it's the regular habit of doing all we can to meet together regularly with the Lord's people, however we may accomplish that. Even if it's by the phone, as many brethren are doing these days, or connecting by the internet, never forsake the assembling of ourselves together. Because out of sight, out of mind, one meeting is very hard to miss, and we may regret it very deeply. We miss two meetings, so it's a little less regret the second time. And by the time we've missed our 40th meeting, it's, okay. And we can see what a slippery slope experience that is. So finally, King David is brought on the scene, and we pick up that account in 2 Samuel. Second Samuel, chapter 6. David got together all the fighting men of Israel to the number of 30,000. And David and all the people who were with him went to Baal of Judah to get the ark of God, over which the holy name is named, the name of the Lord of armies, whose place is between the winged ones. And they put the ark of God on a new cart, and they took it out of the house, and Abinadab, which was on the hill, the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill, and the two sons of Abinadab, Uzzah and Ahio, drove the cart. Well, we miss a little bit of this account. The account in the book of Chronicles tells us that David notes that the ark hadn't been consulted at all in the days of Saul. And that in preparation for bringing the ark up into Jerusalem, David sent out invitations to all the leaders, all the people of influence in Israel, and great orchestrations were made to bring the ark back in. This was a huge occasion in which David laid his reputation on the line. And David and all the men of Israel made melody before the Lord with all their power, with songs and with corded instruments and instruments of brass. And when they came to Nacon's grain floor, Uzzah put his hand on the ark of God to keep it safe in its place, for the oxen were out of control. And that was a bad idea. Well, why shouldn't I put my hand out to hold it? I remember, says Uzzah, growing up as a kid. The ark was in my house, my family. We were the watchkeepers of the ark of God. I should have some sort of special privileges. What's my right? I've known it since I was a kid. And here we learn the lesson that none of us, by virtue of whatever personal merits we have, is an exception from the principles of God. God is no respecter of persons. And that's one thing we love about Him. Or maybe one of those things we love about Him as long as it doesn't apply too strictly to us, ourselves. But we love that about God. He is no respecter of persons. And we learned that lesson here. And you can imagine the discontent and the disquiet. You know, here you have this enormous parade. 30,000 soldiers were there at a minimum. And the leaders of all the people. And you know, you hear throughout all the land of Israel that King David is bringing the ark up. Well, we got to go. How could we miss that? That's a one-in-a-lifetime experience. And so here are these huge crowds, and here's David standing there, you know, the figurehead of the nation, and all the joy that's going on, bringing the ark up, and then Uzzah reaches his hand out to steady the ark, and the Lord slays him dead. And you can imagine the people around him, oh my goodness, and the horn players and the musicians, you know, maybe the instruments started going out of tune and stopping one by one, and David's wondering, what's going on? And he looks back, and it certainly rained on his parade that day. Verse 9 of 2 Samuel 6 tells us that David was greatly in fear of the Lord that day. David was angry at the Lord's outburst of wrath against Uzzah. David said, "How may I let the ark of God come to me?" How indeed? Well, what did they do? They took the ark and they put it in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And maybe we're sitting here saying, wait a minute, it's a bad idea to put it in somebody's house, because the last time we did it, it was 70 years before it came to mind again. But it was a good idea, actually. The ark of the Lord was in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord sent a blessing on Obed-Edom and all his family. And the people even went to King David and they said, "The blessing of the Lord is on the family of Obed-Edom and on all he has because of the ark of God." Here is one of the most remarkable stories in all of Scripture to me. For 70 years, the ark of God is in the house of Abinadab and nothing comes of it. For 3 months, it's in the house of Obed-Edom. And it is evident that the Lord is blessing them and that they're flourishing. You know, maybe Obed-Edom used to walk around with a little arthritis, kind of hunched over and shuffling. And then after it's in his house for a few months, he's walking around and just feeling really great. Maybe his garden didn't have any bugs in the tomatoes anymore. I don't know what it was, but whatever it was so evident to everybody that there was a special blessing. And friends, we can have the truth in our lives for so many years and have no profit from it, to have no fruitage from it. But the truth mustn't just be in our lives, it must be our very life. And in that we will bear much fruit to the glory of God. Well, David made some corrections. He knew that the Lord was blessing them and that it was time to bring the ark of the Lord up into Jerusalem. But they just didn't go about it in the right way. And so he understood that, no, we don't put the ark on a cart and have some dumb beast carry it along. That's not the way to present the presence of God. What should be done is that on the intelligent shoulders of priests, godly people who have a knowledge of the Lord, it should be borne on their shoulders. And they should carry it up to the house of God, its resting place. And so the next time that they brought the ark up, David had priests carry the ark. And he didn't let just anybody sing and play instruments. The second time it was for the priesthood to play and to sing. And that illustrates to us very well that it is no one else's pleasure and privilege to carry the presence of God in this world, but His consecrated, His Spirit-begotten children. Let us always be grateful for the opportunity, and let us do with our might what our hands find to do with regard to it. Well, as David was dancing before the Lord, there was someone looking down upon him and apparently looking down her nose upon him. And that was his wife, Michal. She was the daughter of Saul and had been given to David by Saul. We record or read the record that in the early days, she was very much in love with David. She was smitten. And so Saul gave her to David, and she even put her own life at risk to save David from Saul's guards that he sent to slay him. She let him down by the window. Saul knew it. And just because she was his daughter didn't mean that she wouldn't have been subject to death. But things changed. She lost her first love. And she saw David dancing before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. How could this be? David returns to his home full of joy on this grand occasion. But Michal had reasoned to herself, who is this commoner? He was a boy tending sheep. When my father was the anointed king of Israel, leading them in battle against the Philistines. And he doesn't regard me enough, because I am the king's daughter. I'm going to give him a piece of my mind when he gets home. That was a bad idea. And so, when David returned to his home, coming back to his family in verse 20 of 2 Samuel 6, he came back to give them a blessing, but Michal confronts him and says sarcastically, how full of glory was the king of Israel today, who let himself be seen uncovered by his servant girls like a foolish person, uncovering himself without shame. And David told her, I was dancing before the Lord. I was dancing before the Lord who put me over your father and all his sons to make me a ruler over the people of the Lord, over his people Israel. And I will go on playing before the Lord. And I will do even worse than this. And I'll make myself even lower in your eyes. But the servant girls of whom you were talking will give me honor. And Michal, Saul's daughter, had no child until the day of her death. Well, we do seem to have a contradiction to verse 23, in case you come across it. That contradiction is in 2 Samuel 21, 8. And we read that the king took the two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bare unto Saul, Armoni and Mephibosheth, and the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, whom she brought up for Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Meholathite. It wasn't actually Michal who was the wife of Barzillai. It was her sister. We read First Samuel 18:19 that it was her sister, and I'm not going to look it up because we're out of time. Our chairman is here. But her sister was the one who was married to Barzillai, who had five children with him. It was not Michal. And so the consequence of Michal thinking, I will exert my right here, I'm sticking up for myself, was that she was cast off from David's presence and favor and died childless in her old age. What do we see? We see from this lesson that many reasonable, intelligent, mature people can make very bad decisions based on spontaneous thought, based on assumptions of special favor. And what do we learn from it? That we are to walk humbly with our God. That we are to always realize we are little nobodies that he took from the field and anointed us and brought us into his divine family. And that we have no greater privilege than to obey his will and to submit to it. And a step beyond that, dear friends, time and again, for myself and for you, we come short. We do make mistakes. We do follow through on things that are, in the long run, in hindsight, are a bad idea. But if we confess our sins to him, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sin, and the blood of his Son cleanses us from all iniquity.